Hey everyone, and welcome to Risky Business, your weekly information security news and current affairs show. My name's Patrick Gray. This week's show is brought to you by CMD Security. CMD makes Linux security software that, as you will hear, is proving to be quite popular with Risky Business listeners. CMD's co-founder and chief executive, Jake King, who is an Australian based in Canada, he'll be joining us in this week's sponsor interview to talk about what happened when he came onto the show a couple of months ago to spruik their new freemium offering. And yeah, basically, there was a bit of a stampede. It's a hit. So he'll be along to tell us what shook out of that whole process. And also, he's going to talk a bit about what he's seeing people use the CMD product to do since this crisis began. That is coming up later. But first up, of course, it is time for a check of the week's security news headlines with our good friend Adam Boileau. And Adam, geez, international intrigue galore this week. We'll start off with the United States putting on its cranky pants and yelling at China for going after vaccine data, which, you know, if I'm China, I'm absolutely going to do.
Well, yeah, exactly. Yeah. There's a whole bunch of, like, what did you think was going to happen in some of these stories about international relations? But yeah, US has come out saying, hey, look, China is going after, you know, vaccine companies and all the other sorts of information that you'd want to have about how, you know, the COVID outbreak is being managed around the place, and particularly in the US, but, you know, also around the world. Of course, it's not just the Chinese, as you suggest. Like, everybody who's got some kind of hacking capability and has COVID, which is, I guess, everybody these days, is all up in everybody else's business. Trying to figure out, you know, who's buying PPE and how much they're getting it for and where from and in what ships and, you know, plus all of the...
And who has the supplies of exotic precursors to drugs that may be effective and what drugs may be effective. And, you know, it's funny, I sent a tweet on the 5th of March, saying, I'm just wondering how many SIGINT operators are up to this sort of stuff right now, like COVID-related collection, and they must be feeling pretty dirty. And I retweeted that like the other day, and someone was like, oh, well, you know, if I could help my country by doing that sort of collection, I would. My problem with it is, right, like why I said they would be feeling dirty about it is because none of this is being done in the interests of everyone around the world. Like, this is absolutely about trying to gain an edge on the country next to you, right? Like, everyone's trying to outrun the bear here, and it's a little bit gross.
Yeah, it is. And it would be nice to imagine that we lived in a world where we'd all kind of pull together and we'd have organizations, you know, like the WHO and the UN, you know,
meant
to be. But yeah, that's just not how it be. And it would be nice if it wasn't, but it is how it is, unfortunately. And yeah, everybody is just, you know, trying to go after everybody else's stash.
Yeah, well, and there's a story here about Iran going after Gilead, which is, of course, you know, one of the makers of an experimental drug that is thought to be partially maybe effective against COVID-19. But, you know, Gilead, they are notoriously dishonest. So it's really unclear whether or not that drug even does anything. But the Iranians, maybe we should let the Iranians go over after it. But what I find interesting about that one is that, you know, we saw a big pivot for Iranians started targeting life sciences and pharmaceuticals late last year. And I remember discovering this when Soleimani got vaped back in January. I sort of asked around about, you know, whether we saw an uptick in Iranian activity. We didn't really. We did just see them escalate their campaigns against life sciences and big pharma. And now everyone's reporting this Gilead thing like it's some massive shift. It's not.
No, and I think, you know, the embargoes and the way that Iran has to relate to the rest of the world, I mean, those are the sorts of things that they, you know, are particularly interested in, despite, you know, regardless of whether COVID was going on. I mean, they've got so many, you know, supplies and things that they need that they can't otherwise get that, yeah, of course, they're going to go after, you know, these sorts of things to be able to manufacture things domestically or obtain through other means or whatever else. I mean, yeah, it is, you know, it's part of a thing that they've been dealing with for quite a long time.
Yeah, it looks like a Chinese APT crew, meanwhile, owned up the mail server for the Indonesian embassy in Australia and then used it to, like, send malware docs to the West Australian Premier. That's, for our American listeners, that's, you know, I suppose the equivalent position of governor of Western Australia, which is a really resource-rich part of the world. I mean, it's just China being China, right? Like, you know.
Pretty much, yeah. apparently, they used a phishing lure document from the Indonesian embassy, and according to the reporting, they helped themselves to like a partially finished document that some Indonesian staffer was working on, finished it for them, and then used that as the lure, which, you know, that's kind of nice doing the work for them. You know, good job there, Chinese hackers.
Yeah, they stuffed it full of malware, right?
Well, they stuffed it full of some pretty sweet looking malware, some new tool that the Chinese have been working on. But yeah, I mean, it kind of makes, this is just what, you know, what it looks like when you get hacked by China through the Indonesians, and because why not?
It's funny, right? A few weeks ago, we reported on a story. We discussed a story about Palestinian-linked groups going after water treatment facilities in Israel. I saw some subsequent reports that I don't think we discussed, that perhaps Iran may have had a hand in that. They've been having some problems of their own lately. Funny that.
Iran is reporting that a bunch of facilities, you know, computer facilities in a port in the Strait of Hormuz were compromised by something. It sounds like parts of the port got shut down. They're not particularly clear. I guess, you know, Iranians, you know, when they're at the point when they're having to admit that they got stuff owned for their own domestic press, then, you know, it must have been something that they can't avoid talking about. But yeah, I don't know who would want to go after shipping facilities in Iran. Like, who would want to
after,
do that?
I mean, after attacks in Israel, you know, who would think? Like them to retaliate in this sort of way. But look, I think the reason they had to address this is because there was actually a friendly fire incident, a Navy-friendly fire incident around the same time, which resulted in the death of 19 sailors and injuries to 15 others. So then the rumor mill started saying that this cyber attack, you know, word of it had sort of got out, was somehow linked to the friendly fire incident, and obviously they had to come and clean that up. Now Zoom has acquired Keybase. That's been some very big industry news over the last week. You know, I think Alex Stamos is possibly behind this. You know, he of course is doing a side gig with Zoom while he's at Stanford University to like help whip their security into shape. We had a big chat about that on the Risky Business live stream yesterday with Alex Stamos, with Sherrod DiGrippo, and with Dmitry Alperovich. That was a lot of fun. Go check it out if you haven't already. So yeah, it looks like what's happened here is Zoom has acquired Keybase, and they're going to get the Keybase engineers to work on standing up some sort of end-to-end capability, encryption capability for Zoom. To me, this looks like an acqui-hire. You and I were talking last year about all of the spam problems plaguing Keybase and a lot of users leaving. So this looks like perhaps it's like an alternative exit for the people involved at Keybase.
Yeah, I mean, it really does look like they're after the people and their experience building the current Keybase products rather than the actual Keybase products as they are at the moment. And I, you know, if you were relying on those products for something, I would be a little sus about what the future, you know, is going to look like a couple of years from now. Like, I don't know that you're going to see a lot of, you know, continued life on those things. But yeah, like the people and the expertise that they've got in building distributed crypto systems and key management, like there's just a lot of really fiddly stuff there that you're going to screw up. Like as Gutman says, you're going to screw it up the first 14 times you implement it. So buy somebody who's done it the first 14 and then you've got a chance of getting it right.
And that's 100% what this looks like to me as well. It's a soft landing for a bunch of really talented people who work well together. Like, great.
Yeah, I mean, that seems like a good outcome for them, probably a good outcome for Zoom, good outcome for Zoom's customers, maybe less so, you know, if you're someone who was using Keybase for something already.
Yeah, but I mean, we don't know what their plans are there. We'll see.
No, we
but
don't.
You're
we
right.
Don't.
I mean, it doesn't make you think, wow, you know, Keybase is going to the moon. Right? Like, yeah, so I think you do make a good point. Now we're going to talk about some Thunderbolt research that has been the source of some controversy on the old InfoSec Twitters over the last few days. Some people saying that this is, you know, massively overhyped. Generally, I find it's not usually the researchers who do the overhyping when this happens. It's usually the media and various people promoting the work. Did you have a chance to look through this? Tell us what the go is here.
This is some research into the security measures introduced to Thunderbolt to try and mitigate the sorts of, you know, direct memory access attacks we've seen across earlier instances of Thunderbolt, across, you know, FireWire going back when I was working in this kind of space, and, you know, other PCIe interfaces, other DMA-capable interfaces that are exposed outside of your computer. So there were some controls introduced previously that prevent you from just, like, you know, plugging in a device and accessing main memory and doing bad things. This researcher has looked into those controls and found some mechanisms to bypass them so that you can, you know, then go ahead and use all of the existing tools for doing DMA attacks. The bit where people have got their, you know, got a little bit kind of, you know, I suppose the bit where it's been overhyped is that these attacks all essentially require you to open the case of the computer and then reprogram the flash that stores the firmware or the configuration of the Thunderbolt controller, which, you know, for the scenarios of like evil maid attack, like you leave your laptop, you know, sleeping but unattended in a hotel room, someone comes in, plugs a device in, backdoors it so that they can get credentials if you're descriptor or steal the data or whatever on, you know, other stuff later on. Like for that scenario, you really want something you can just plug in, right? And that's where the card bus.
So hang on, for this, you actually have to, you have to power it down, remove something, reflash it, put it back on. Is that how it works? Or
so you do it while it's on. Okay. So you want the main memory contents to stay, because I mean you're talking about things that are full disk cryptoed, so you need it to be powered on for it to be any use.
That's why
in the first
I was curious,
place.
Right? Yeah.
So for that scenario, like having to pull the back off a laptop and then clip onto the spy flash and reflash it, I mean, in some machines, that's going to be quite doable, you know. And the example that the guy used in the demo video, which is some of Lenovo, where the spy flash is quite easily accessible once you pull the back off, like, not unreasonable. Like, he demos it in a few minutes, right? That's doable. But it's very dependent per device where those flash are, how accessible it is, like whether you can realistically clip something on, whether you have to solder. So for the evil maid situation, it's a little bit kind of, it depends. It's not, you know, it could be bad in some scenarios. But for law enforcement, you know,
well, that's what I was just thinking. Like for a seized laptop in the middle of a raid, the thing happens to be locked, but it's powered up. I mean, just keep that bad boy on charge while you figure it out, right?
Well, exactly. And of course, the police already have equipment for, you know, hot swapping power on stuff so they can keep stuff powered up when they seize it. And for in the law enforcement context, this is actually really ideal. Like, this is tooling they already know how to use in terms of using the DMA to get access, image main memory, bypass authentication, you know, get access to crypto keys. This is just another step to then re-enable that attack where hardware has these, you know, preventions turned on. And it's worth mentioning that the preventions that this is bypassing are pretty recent anyway. I mean, the older Thunderbolt was already not very well protected. So in those scenarios, and we will see this weaponized, I think, for law enforcement use. But, you know, it's for a consumer, it's just not that exciting. And of course, also macOS basically not vulnerable to this because of the different way that it implements security controls for Thunderbolt and DMA devices in general. So we're kind of talking Windows, Linux on commodity hardware with Thunderbolt controllers. If you can open it up and get access to the chip, then your powered on machine could be compromised, which, you know,
well, it's going to be very useful for law enforcement, right? So, you know, it sounds like good work. Absolutely sounds like good work. I think the funny thing is, like, the reason I was wondering if you had to power it down to reflash that, because you could sneak in, power it down, you know, reflash a chip, then wait for the person to come back, use the computer again, power it up, and then you've got it. But no, I mean, if you can do this just with a powered up device without having to power it off, I mean, fantastic.
I mean, the scenario you're describing where you power it off is also viable, because the guy demonstrates that you can patch the config in the spy flash to turn off the security controls or to pull the list of devices that are authorized so that you can bypass security controls, and then lock the flash, so set the right protect on the flash so that the user then can't change the config or repatch it. So you could do that in a multi-touch attack where you know, can power off the machine, apply that, and then come back in the future knowing that the Thunderbolt, you're just going to have to plug in from the outside and be able to bypass the security because it's already been done the internal step. So you could break it up like that. So there's quite a lot of options for using it in the wild, but I do think we're only going to see it in a law enforcement context.
Yeah, but I don't think that makes it in and of itself overhyped, right?
No, I mean, there's plenty of other things people should do instead of worrying about their Thunderbolts, right?
No, you're right. You're absolutely right. The FBI and DHS dropping more North Korean malware. This is fun. I notice how they don't really do it they haven't done it to anyone else, right? You wonder if they're going to do this to, like, the Chinese. You know what I mean? Because the Chinese are real sensitive and weird, as we in Australia know. But, you know, kicking around the North Koreans, heaps of fun.
Yeah, exactly right. And, you know, we have seen them being, you know, kind of dropping stuff on VT and uploading, you know, IOCs and things. But this is, you know, there's the technical aspect of, like, sharing some of these details amongst the security community. And then there's the kind of making a song and dance out of it aspect, just to rub North Korea's nose in it. And, of course, to send a message to the others. I think that's part of it as well, right? I mean, you know, dropping all of China's stuff in the same way, you know, I guess that's a thing the Chinese would have to think about if they are seeing it being done to other people. So, yeah, I think you're right. There's a bit of, you know, showboating to make an example here, and we may see them do it to somebody else. I don't know.
Now, in Ghana, a bunch of people have just gone to prison for buying NSO Group. You know, a bunch of Ghana government people have gone to prison for buying NSO Group software, which is pretty interesting. And it looks like they were also involved in a bunch of other shady stuff. They were just generally corrupt. And someone enriched themselves about $200,000 in the process of acquiring the NSO software. I think they made themselves a reseller or something. But yeah, it's all pretty shady stuff. This is another one from CyberScoop.
Yeah, it's a little bit vague exactly what they went down for, like enriching themselves through this process.
Well, but I think also buying the software when they didn't need it was a part of it. So the whole thing just was shady. They got yeah, sent to prison for being shady.
Some of the reporting from Ghana did suggest that they bought the hardware to run it on and then didn't get the software. So they just spent the money and presumably got whatever kickbacks were involved. And then it never was in a position to be used. I think that's kind of how it read to me. But yeah, either way, you know, going to prison for buying your software is not a great customer story, you know, for NSO Group marketing. So maybe don't use this one as a testimonial.
And their high court there has ordered them to pay $3 million, you know. So they're clawing most of the money back, which is pretty hectic. But yeah, that wasn't one that I expected to see this week. apparently, according to Brian Krebs, Europe's largest private hospital operator, a group called Fresenius, has been hit by ransomware. This is not good. This is not what we want.
Really not good. This is, you know, this is like a big organization. This is what 300,000 people work there. Like, so it's not a small operation. And yeah, them getting ransomware, I mean, it's going to have effect all across Europe. And you know, I wouldn't want to be the ransomware operators responsible for this.
But, no, I mean, it's time to release the hounds for sake. You know, come on, let's do it.
Kind of, yeah. Like, this is not, it's just not tolerable.
Yeah. And, yeah, but you can't imagine the Europeans moving early on this, right? Because they're different to us. You know,
I guess we will see how much they're willing to put up with, you know, before whatever it is that they're going to do. They're going to do something, surely.
Yeah, maybe. Diebold also got smashed with ransomware, but that's funny.
I mean, it kind of is. So yeah, Diebold got smashed by, I think, Prolog ransomware, which is quite an old crew. Diebold, you know, make a bunch of things, including ATM hardware. But one of the things that I liked about this story is they came out and said, without a trace of irony, Diebold takes the security of our systems and customer services very seriously. The hint of irony.
I mean, they must have got the modern equivalent of Don Draper to write that one up. I mean, that was glorious, amazing writing. Good work there, PR team.
They said, of course, it was just our corporate network. No one got onto any ATMs, no one got any software, no one got into any customers, which, I mean, it's just a straight up lie.
I don't believe you.
Exactly, right? I mean, that's one of those extraordinary claims that requires extraordinary proof. Like, for what reason would you not be able to get onwards to everything else from access to corporate, especially when you're getting, you know, owned that much at corporate? But I mean, this is a pattern we saw, I think, with one of the other examples, Cognizant, that got themselves ransomware, saying the same thing, right? I mean, Cognizant, of course, are a big, you know, IT service provider, got themselves ransomware as well, and they said the same thing, like, it was just the corporate network, no one got onto customer networks, nothing important happened, which, yeah, I just don't believe. And the thing is, like, when we're seeing ransomware operators that are human-led, right, these are not, you know, once they get access to the network, they do their recon, they move around laterally by hand and, you know, actually expend some effort to get into the right place to be able to, you know, extract value out of their targets. The idea that they wouldn't go down links to customers, like, it's just, is dumb, right? Of course they're going to. They may not be doing it now. They're definitely going to do it next year, you know, when things start to get harder. So those responses really do, you know, get my goat, as you probably know.
Look, I think anyone who puts, you know, we take customers, the security of customer information very seriously. Anyone who puts that in a statement while denying that customers were affected at all, I mean, they're red flags to those of us who've been following this stuff long enough, right? Like, they're giant red flags.
And, I mean, and people in particular are total garbage. Like, I mean, that's just yeesh.
But Cognizant reckons it's going to cost him between $50 to $70 million in direct costs for the quarter. But, you know, as Brett wrote in this week's Seriously Risky Biz newsletter, it's probably going to cost him a little bit more in terms of customers who might be walking away. So, yeah, there's that as well. Pitney Bowes, which is a package delivery giant, also having some trouble with ransomware. This is the Maze Crew. So that's bad. I mean, this is the second time in 7 months they've been hit. And we're having some trouble here in Australia, where last week we spoke about how Toll Group was being ransomwared for the second time this year. They've been responsible for distributing the seasonal flu vaccine here in Australia. So now those supplies are being disrupted. Release the hounds.
Yeah, this is, you know, the sorts of things you get when you mess with supply chain. And yeah, once again, just kind of not a thing that we should be willing to put up with, I don't think.
Oh, and I've included a link this week from FireEye. They've done a bunch of work just looking at Maze ransomware and how that crew rolls. Pretty interesting read.
Yeah, it has a good list of the kinds of techniques they use for, you know, privilege escalation, lateral movement, you know, lined up with the attack framework, all the things you kind of need to be able to explain it to, you know, the people who are doing monitoring inside your network. So yeah, definitely worth a read if you're concerned about being a target for ransomware, which is everybody, right?
Yeah. The Department of Homeland Security in the United States through CISA has put out an advisory saying online voting, are you mad? It's essentially what this communique says. You know, the DHS has come out very strongly against online voting. This is interesting.
Yeah, this is good. I mean, we do need some kind of leadership in this space, because in the US, like with the distributed kind of structure of the voting mechanisms, there's a lot of scope for states to do their own thing. And having some guidance that kind of says, no, just getting an app to do it isn't the great idea. You know, obviously it is a complicated problem to solve, and there are some real things that do need to be addressed. But yeah, having some guidance, you know, from DHS on the subject, I think is probably a useful contribution to the you know, development of this.
Yeah, well, it's all out war on mail-in voting from the Republicans in the United States. I mean, we even had Donald Trump retweeting James Woods, I think just yesterday, where he'd posted pictures of some envelopes and said, see, unattended ballots, the fraud potential is amazing, you know. So, and Trump, yeah, funnily enough, you know, because he just says stuff that comes into his head, before he began this campaign, he said, oh no, we don't support mail-in voting because it doesn't favour us, right? So he's like, we're less likely to win because of mail-in voting. And then they start this giant disinformation campaign about mail-in voting. You know, and our thoughts to everyone in the United States at the moment, all of our listeners who are suffering at the moment. I didn't even realize just quite how bad things in the States had got, because here we're getting a lot of news about New York, not a lot of news about the rest of the country. But I did have a look recently, and I did not know it was that bad. So our thoughts are with you over there in the United States. Catalin Kimpanu has done a really good job in this next one of unpicking reports that Microsoft had a bunch of its internal GitHubs owned up, right? But it turns out not really a big deal.
Yeah, it sounds like someone, you know, got access to an employee, Microsoft employee's account that had access to the, you know, the private repos in Microsoft's account, dumped it all out, and then, you know, went on a bit of a phishing expedition to try and find something worth leaking. According to Microsoft, the sorts of things that were in that repo, you know, it's kind of stuff that they intend to open source at some point, or stuff that's not particularly sensitive. It's not core Windows or anything like that. And yeah, there's also a bunch of other, you know, kind of open source stuff and bits and pieces in there. So, you know, the numbers we saw floating around, like, oh my God, 500 gig of Microsoft source code stolen, you know, kind of not really representative of the severity of it. And yeah, overall, I don't know that. I mean, obviously, it's not a great look. I mean, Microsoft being more open and open sourcing stuff and interacting with the community through GitHub is a really good thing. Anything that kind of puts a break on that is not ideal, I don't think. But yeah, I don't know that anyone's really going to be losing a whole bunch of sleep over this one.
And a shout out too to Catalin this week, because after our live stream yesterday, he tweeted at us that he made some nachos and was getting ready to watch the Michael Jordan documentary, and wound up watching our live stream instead, which is high praise. So thank you very much to Catalin Kimpanu. Staying with GitHub though, GitHub has a whole bunch of new code scanning stuff. Like, we've seen them progressively turn this up over the last few years, and you know, it's really good stuff.
Yeah, I mean, they've got a lot of really good security expertise in-house now. A lot of people who are, you know, experienced at building tooling and figuring out programmatic ways to look for bugs in the code base. And I mean, one of the goals they talked about was, you know, building signatures for all of the relevant CVEs for software that's on GitHub, so they can go and find classes of bugs across the entire set of code that lives there and then communicate that clearly. And there's just a lot of really good thinking around, you know, you know, there's so much open source software where the maintainers, you know, don't really have security as a core expertise, maybe not even have software development as a core expertise, right? They've stumbled into maintaining a piece of software that's important in the overall ecosystem and supporting them building, you know, tools and things around them. That's, you know, a thing that GitHub is exactly for, right? Supporting developers and building tools to make that work. And yeah, they seem to be doing a pretty good job of it. And actually, one of the things that kind of made me laugh about this was, you know, because GitHub is spending so much time and effort here, you know, focusing on security and securing things that are developed on GitHub, that we're going to end up kind of seeing, you know, two classes of software, you know, software that's developed on GitHub and inherits all of those extra, you know, kind of leg up from GitHub. And then all of the other stuff, like, and if you've got a, you know, if you're looking for bugs in something, you know, go and find code that's hosted on, you know, savannah.gnu.org or something, because you know it's not going to have the same level of automated scrutiny.
But Adam, you're missing something of critical importance here, which is, you know, GitHub, terribly, awfully, is owned by Microsoft. How can you be praising it, man? It's time we all get off that platform, dude.
Microsoft with doing? A dollar sign. Yeah.
That's exactly what I was going to say next, man. Moving on to this next story here, the Australian Taxation Office apparently, and I love the headline, Australian Tax Office detects fraud over early superannuation scheme. Essentially in Australia, we have like, you know, pensions that we pay into. They're like, you know, self-funded pensions, superannuation, we call it. And as part of the coronavirus sort of response, you can actually pull a little bit of money out of your pension at the moment, right? So that's one thing they're doing. Now, what's happened here is the ATO has said, yes, we've detected these fraud attempts and, you know, $100,000 went bye-bye, but we detected it and we shut it down. There has been talk of it being a third party. Now, what I understand has happened here is the third party involved was an accounting firm. They got themselves popped, right? And I'm guessing, you know, that was their trusted access was used to start processing this stuff. The really funny thing about the ATO claiming to have detected it, though, is what I hear happened is that it was actually one of the superannuation funds that detected people trying to put money into different bank accounts than they had on file, like, 10 days ago, so really good fraud controls, and they were the ones who alerted the ATO, right? And then the ATO comes out and says, yes, well, we shut the whole thing down. But, you know, this is that type of, you know, very similar to the sorts of scams that target the IRS and whatnot. We don't usually see this sort of stuff in Australia to the same degree. So it's like, welcome to that. Welcome to being a destination for that sort of crime, you know?
Yeah, and it kind of makes sense, you know, because they're going to use the same techniques in other countries, and there's, you know, there's plenty of other places in the world other than the US that you can go and extract money through this kind of approach. And yeah, we'll see it, I think, all around the world. So all of the you know, tax officers and people like that are going to have to be prepared for this sort of thing.
Now, look, speaking of the Australian government being full of shit, last week I mentioned that they were doing there was a Senate hearing happening into the COVID Safe app. The government basically spent last Wednesday confirming our reporting over the period of a day. And they did really come out and say, yes, look, the reason we rushed it out the door is because we wanted to have something rather than nothing and, you know, to build that install base. So they did actually front up and spell out their strategy. And after we'd all heard it, we thought, okay, look, you know, you might not even necessarily agree with the strategy or the communications around the strategy, but it's at least it's not insane. They are strongly indicating that they're going to move to the Apple and Google model soon, but they keep saying, oh yes, Apple's improving its Bluetooth, like Apple's the problem and not them not waiting. And there was one thing that they said that was clearly a lie, which was we wanted to get something out now instead of waiting 6 to 12 months. When really it would have been a case of waiting like 3 to 4 weeks, right? Yeah. So, yeah. But, you know, all said and done, everything's, you know, whatever. Microsoft has pushed out some data saying that 150 million people are now using passwordless logins using Microsoft Tech. This is interesting. I mean, I did a sponsor interview recently with Mark Rogers from Okta where he was sort of spruiking their passwordless stuff. It does kind of feel like 2020 might be the year that we make really meaningful progress on killing passwords. Thank God.
Yeah, I mean, it does look that way. I mean, Microsoft's saying, 90% of internal users are using Hello to log into things. So, I mean, that's a pretty significant move from passwords. And yeah, passwords are the source of so many, you know, kind of ways that we are going to attack stuff, and anything that gets those out of the loop, even for, you know, smaller than 90%, would be a pretty big improvement. So yeah, I think you're right. We are seeing real, you know, kind of genuine change, you know, move towards it, I suppose. Not everybody is going to be in a position to do that kind of thing. But, you know, Microsoft pushing it on the desktops with Hello, and then, you know, companies like Okta and Google's work on pushing security keys and things. You know, there's a lot of movement that's, you know, just taken passwords out of some of these flows day to day.
Yeah, no, 100%. Facebook, this isn't technically a security story, but it's sort of tangentially related, I guess. Facebook is paying $52 million to settle a lawsuit brought by content moderators who develop PTSD on the job. And, you know, this is just, we forget about the human cost of this stuff, you know?
Yeah, it's very easy to say, oh, well, we'll just get humans to deal, you know, put humans in the loop in the system somewhere to deal with whatever problem the tech can't quite handle yet. And yeah, we don't necessarily think about what that means for the people. And I think we talked, you know, there was a, was it a Vice story last year, a couple of years ago, that we talked about on the show, you know, talking through really quite how terrible being a Facebook content moderator was. And, you know, the this particular settlement, which is like, what, $50 million, comes out to like, $1,000 each, plus maybe some more if you get diagnosed with PTSD. Like, that seems pretty stingy given, you know, you have to spend, you know, 40 hours a week looking at the worst possible scum on the internet. So seems a bit thin to me.
Yeah, I mean, we got to think about this sort of material as being like a radioactive substance. The longer you are exposed to it, the more it damages your health, you know? And there's a lot of work being done on that. And yeah, we got to think. Look, a lawsuit like this says that they need to think about this now, right? And that's got to be a good thing. And
yeah, definitely a good start.
Exactly. Whether or not it's about a couple of $1,000 each or whatever, it's a movement in the right direction. So that's good. What do we got? Oh, talk us through this one. This is really like using a fav icon, like a shady fav icon that pops up as an image most of the time, but then like bursts out as JavaScript on payment pages. Like, what the hell, Adam? What is this?
This crew that does the kind of Magecart style skimming payment details off the forms thing. They came up with a scheme where they made like they cloned a site that had like logos of all sorts of stuff. And they made a service that ostensibly just kind of hosted icons for popular software. And then they'd own the target platform and then switch the fav icon to use their like fav icon hosting service. And then that service would figure out when the referrer was the payment page. And at that point would switch over to serving, you know, the JavaScript that was going to do the actual scraping. So the rest of the time it just looked like legit. We're using the icons from some third party service because we're stupid. Rather than actually being malware, which is,
you got to hand it to them.
Yeah, well, exactly, right? I mean, it's dumb, but it works. Hey, you know.
Fantastic.
I don't know that it quite meets the bar of one of the most complex and innovative hacking campaigns detected to date that Catalan wrote it up with, though.
Yes. Yeah, no, I agree. But I still give him MVP this week because he smashed out some great ones. Like, how did everyone else kind of miss this one? Samsung's patched this bug, right? Affecting every smartphone it's sold since 2014. And it's an image parsing bug that only affects Samsung. This is Project Zero who found this one. But holy shit, like, how is this one kept so quiet?
Yeah, I'm surprised that this one didn't get more coverage. I mean, this is bug in image parsing. You can deliver it via MMS, and the Google researchers who worked it up have an info leak to get past the ASLR. They have a method to deliver the MMSs such that they don't trigger the alert, so you don't actually see it, and then leads to code exec, which, like, that's exactly what you want from a zero-user interaction, remote, you know, phone number targetable.
No, it's mobile phone glorious. Bug. It is glorious, this work. Like, just amazing. It is the holy grail.
Yeah, I mean, it's exactly what the NSO groups of this world, you know, pay so much money for, this kind of bug. So, yeah, I'm surprised it didn't get more traction. And the fact that it's so
You know why? Because it's not in an iPhone. That's why, you know?
Exactly.
You say Samsung, no one cares. But, I mean, how many phones did Samsung make? I'm guessing it's quite a few.
A lot, right?
Yeah. But what the hell are they doing using their own? What is this QMage? Hell is that? Format?
Who even knows, right? I mean, there's so many stupid image formats. I don't know what Samsung's thinking. But yeah, next question is, are they going to patch it? So yes, they've released some patches. Does anyone apply security patches to their Samsung phones? Like, can you even practically do it on a real carrier with a real phone? I don't know. Does anyone who uses a Samsung phone know? Probably not.
Ah, now this one's funny, right? So a Department of Defense agency put out a bulletin, this is in the US, that has just confused the absolute utter shit out of everyone. And Shannon Vavra wrote it up for Cyberscoop.
Yes, they put out an advisory saying that the Chinese are doing something that involves getting data in and out of defense contractors, and there's a sinkhole involved run by some, you know, third-party company, and that sinkhole is leaking? I don't
it's know. A leaky sinkhole. That'd be your problem right there, buddy. You got a leaky sinkhole.
It's very it's expensive. Cost you a bit.
Yeah, exactly.
Going to have to get a new part from Spain.
That's right. Yeah. So give me more. Give me more. There's more here.
Well, we don't really know. I mean, this particular bit of the Department of Defense is called the Defense Counterintelligence and Security Agency, which I'd never heard of. But yeah, they haven't subsequently clarified what they mean. The company that operates the sinkhole is a company, Anubis. I think they're Portuguese, but owned by Boston-based company. They said they don't know what this means. They're pretty sure that their sinkholes don't leak. Exactly. It's just confusing. I mean, it seems like presumably at some point there was something they actually meant to convey, and it's been through so many levels of people that don't know what the cybers are that the words have been turned into, you know, things that don't make any sense to anybody. So
that's pretty funny. DEFCON and Black Hat are off. It's official. I mean, they're doing some virtual conference thing by video stream, but like they're cancelled. We predicted that back in March, and some people said we were way too early to pull the trigger on that, but it was pretty clear. It was pretty clear that this whole situation was unlikely to resolve in time. And even if it did resolve in time, we were unlikely to have the certainty that we'd need to plan for something like this, you know, tens of thousands of people all heading to the desert, you know, like not going to happen.
No, and I, you know, obviously at some point the DEFCON is cancelled meme had to come true, and yes, you know, at least the circumstances for this are pretty serious, you know. So, you know, yeah, it's good that they've made that call. And, you know, I've got a lot of sympathy being a fellow con organiser, and obviously not at the scale of DEFCON, because, oh lordy, that gave me some con organiser feels going to DEFCON, seeing the scale of the operation that they run. My God, I feel, yeah, I don't know how Jeff does it. But yeah, they've made the hard call. I can't imagine dealing with Caesar's lawyers or, you know, all of that drama would have been at all fun. But yeah, that was the right call to make. And it'll be interesting to see what comes, you know, in a year from now.
Yeah. Yeah, or if we do manage to put the bloody wheels back on in time for it to happen next year.
Well, yeah, right. I mean, who knows?
Let's see. Now, we got two skateboarding dogs this week. This one, man, just gorgeous, glorious. For 8 years, this is the headline, for 8 years, a hacker operated a massive IoT botnet just to download anime videos.
Apparently a German guy.
For personal use.
This German guy called Stefan, apparently. He wrote a piece of malware that would infect, like, D-Link NASs and stuff. He had, like, 10,000 bots in his botnet at the peak. And, yeah, he didn't even look at the contents of the NASs that he was owning. Just downloaded anime. And I'm a little confused as to why downloading anime to somebody else's NAS is helpful. But I mean, what do I know, right? What do I know?
Yeah, I mean, I don't quite get that either. But apparently it was just... I don't know. It was just for lols and downloading anime. But look, our second skateboarding dog, and boy, oh boy, did we have some fun in Slack talking about this one. This is a Cisco ASA bug involving Kerberos that, like, honestly, I'd never really looked at how Kerberos actually works until I did some homework, you know, reading about this one. And I got the double barrel lols of, like, kind of understanding how Kerberos works and thinking, okay, that's just insane. And then looking at this bug, which is, like, equally stupid and insane, I just sort of sat there, like, twitching, basically, for a couple of hours after reading about this. But walk us through it, Adam, because it's glorious.
Oh, dear. Right, so Cisco ASA, which is, you know, firewall VPN product, one of the ways you can do authentication for administrative access and I think also for end-user access, you know, when you're using it in the VPN kind of termination sort of role, it can use Kerberos to integrate with, typically it's going to be Windows, you know, Microsoft Active Directory, so it can authenticate incoming admin users against the Corp AD. It's supported Kerberos for a long time. Kerberos is, you know, the better of the authentication mechanisms supported by AD, I suppose. But, you know, Kerberos in itself is 30 years old now and predates a lot of modern thinking about how to do authentication. And it's really kind of obtuse and complicated and has a lot of moving parts that you have to get right. Anyway, so when you're authenticating by Kerberos, essentially you author the domain controller, you get a ticket that says, yes, you're Steve. Then when you want to go talk to the ASA to go admin it, you ask the Kerberos infrastructure, hey, I'm going to go talk to the ASA. Can you give me a specific ticket for the ASA, which says that I'm Steve and I want to log into that. You go, you give that to the ASA. It has to then go validate that ticket with the Kerberos infrastructure itself. to do that safely, there's authentication between the ASA device, the thing that's authenticating the ticket in this case, and the central domain controller. Turns out that Cisco didn't implement that auth step. So it will go and talk to a domain controller to ask whether the service ticket was valid. If you can get in the middle of that comm, so if you're on the network between the ASA and the domain controller, you can just say yes, and then it lets you off. And the funny thing is, right, it's not like this is an optional feature that they screwed up or whatever. Like, there just isn't even a dialog box to put in this password because they just never implemented it. Like, it's just never worked.
Please describe your meme.
The classic Drake meme, where Drake does not want any of the default passwords. But what Drake does want is Kerberos without even a password box.
There you go. And we may have texted this one to Brad Arkin, who is now the CISO of Cisco. You know, you can imagine what it would be like for him at this difficult time. But yeah, holy God, man. Like, dear. And that's just, I mean, just that's bad.
Well, and the thing is, you can see how it happens, right? I mean, because no one understands how Kerberos works. And whichever ASA dev got told to implement the feature would have just cargo-culted it until it kind of worked and called it done, right? I mean, that's just how everybody implements
Kerberos. That's how enterprise features become, that's, you know, that's how they're born. That's how Babby is made.
That is how enterprise is formed, yes.
That is right. So, I mean, what does this get you, though? This gets you Privesque, basically. Once you're on the inside, this gets you everything, right?
Yes. I mean, if you're on the local network between the admin and the ASA, you can auth to the ASA. And if that's the security control of the edge of the network, then that gets you a lot. So impact real high. Likelihood, I mean, it's kind of fiddly to actually do. And honestly, if you're on the internal network near the firewall admin, you're probably already one. So I don't know if anyone's going to get wrecked by this in the same way as, you know, Citrix bugs or, you know, PulseVPN bugs or something. But still, like, come on, Cisco. It's a security device. Make the auth work. Jeez.
Anyway, that was pretty funny. I've linked through to the write-up from Decipher from Dennis Fisher. But, you know, you Google around, you're going to find all the details on that one you want. Just before we go, I wanted to mention that Andy Greenberg has written up a big profile on Marcus Hutchins, aka Malware Tech. A lot of people seem very interested in his story, and they've written, you know, this is the cover story, and they've put him on the cover as the hacker who saved the internet, which I think might be putting it on a little bit thick. But I will say one thing is, like, I've gradually, over the last few years, found Marcus Hutchins less and less irritating in his Twitter persona. It's just been amazing watching him kind of grow up. And, you know, these days he tends to say quite insightful things. Have you noticed that?
Yeah, no, it does. I mean, you can really see the kind of progression. And the story is honestly very relatable, right? I mean, it's a quite human story of what it's like being a young, quite gifted, you know, hacker without a really clear, you know, moral grounding, a real clear glue to the rest of the world. And the story is, you know, with, you know, substance abuse and mental health. And, like, it's just a very relatable story for so many people in this industry. And, you know, that arc, you know, of how he ends up where he is now, you know, genuinely contributing to the industry and stuff is just, yeah, it's a good read. And, you know, I think a good tale for anyone who's, you know, looking around and seeing, you know, younger hackers who wants to provide guidance, you know, to help people get through, you know, what was a very, clearly for Marcus, a very difficult period of his life. And I think, yeah, it's just a really relatable story and very much worth reading.
All right, that's it. That's it for this week's show. I've dropped a link to this week's newsletter written by Brett. Fantastic stuff, as always. There is a subscribe link. Like, we don't even have a subscribe link on the main site yet, but if you go into any of our posts, it's there. Okay, I can assure you. There's the YouTube stream from this week is embedded in the newsletter as well, so you can check it out there. Head to risky.biz, you will see what I mean. But mate, what a pleasure to chat to you again this week. Good stuff, and we'll do it all again next week. Cheers.
Yeah, I'll talk to you then, Pat.
That was Adam Boileau there with a look at the week's security news. Big thanks to him for that. Next up, it is time to chat with Jake King, the co-founder and chief executive of CMD Security. Jake is Australian, but the company is based in Canada. And I personally think it's very useful software. Basically, it can monitor and control executions on Linux hosts. So if you really want to boil it down to basics, that's what it does. Essentially, you can use this thing to monitor execution data in your Linux environment. And going a step further, you can actually start restricting executions. Think of it as an extra layer of like permissions control, but centrally managed in a not crazy way. They also have cool stuff like Duo integration. So you can do stuff like push yes or no prompts to Linux admins for every sudo command someone is trying to run on boxes they administer. It's just cool and useful stuff. Back in February, Jake joined us to announce what was essentially an exclusive offer to Risky Business listeners. They had a freemium product and listeners could sign up to get their hands on it. And the freemium product doesn't offer all features, but certainly offers enough to be useful without people having to pay for the full version. And their plan was that they were going to announce this to Risky Business listeners and then push to GA and do it that way. It was like a staggered launch. But basically what happened is when Jake announced this on the show, there was like a stampede of Risky Business listeners. So they haven't actually pushed it out to GA yet. There's still a few people left in the queue just based on that podcast from back in February. As you'll hear, Jake says they're catching up, right? But he joins us this week to talk about all of that craziness from February and also to fill us in on how people are using the CMD software differently since the COVID crisis set in. Here's Jake King.
Honestly, thank you for everyone listening that signed up and got into the list. It's been awesome to work with a lot of you on your feedback and hear all the things you love and hate and see how we can improve things. We are pretty through that list, but not entirely through it. So if folks haven't got a trial yet, they're not in the product yet. It will be happening very soon.
It's funny, right? Because the original plan was, we're going to push it out through Risky Business first and then open it up wider. And then it turned out to be so popular with our audience that you haven't really pushed it out anywhere else.
it's been one of those things. You kind of feel that, it might resonate with this kind of audience. It might resonate in a pretty cool way. You know, obviously we get a lot of listeners that come in and check out the product, kind of check out the technology. And a lot of that was directed towards the enterprise folks, people in larger companies, people in larger orgs. So we're really happy to see a pretty overwhelming response to the kind of feedback and the free product. And we're still feeling pretty good about it though, and have made a lot of improvements. So again, thank you for those that have given feedback along the way.
It's good. It's like half a sales pipeline and half a beta testing pipeline, right? Which works well. And you did have some conversions like pretty much immediately, didn't you? Like some people who were like, yep, okay, this does what we needed to do. Hook us up with a license.
Yeah. We had a lot of people coming through really to just kind of address just an auditability concerns. Like, hey, look, I just want to see what's going on. And pretty quickly found some, let's say, concerning things that they wanted to address. Same time, I think we've just seen a pretty overwhelming response from folks that have just wanted to kick the tires and kind of get into it. You know, I guess the one thing being more of you reached out than we kind of anticipated. So it's been a little bit slower than we expected to get it out the door.
But it's always an interesting test, right? Like to see what the response is to these interviews, right? Because sometimes someone will pitch something that frankly isn't that interesting and it'll just be crickets, right? Like I just feel like the audience for this podcast generally as a group makes pretty good decisions. So that's cool. I'm glad that's working out. Now look, since we last spoke, a few things have changed in the world. Things just have got a little bit crazy. And we were speaking just earlier in the lead up to this interview, and one thing that you found is that people are currently like trialing and buying CMD to do different stuff. How has usage of your stuff actually changed? Because that's interesting.
I think we've seen it change in a couple of different ways, Pat. You know, primarily it's been through different ways that people want to use things like multi-factor authentication much faster. You know, they want to really run towards kind of, you know, the fact that every one of those production SSH keys or the SSM keys that people are leveraging to jump into Prada kind of sitting on someone's laptop in their living room, kind of the anxiety that brings and the, I guess, the concern for the security posture that it brings to their org has been.
So what they're using you for their Duo integration, more or less.
Pretty much. But I think more interestingly on the other side of it, they're using us for compliance. A lot of companies are kind of saying, well, you know, hey, look, how is COVID impacting your security posture? Is it changing things for the way your developers are working from home? Are you adding extra security controls to defend the application? And look, we're even getting some of those questions now from some of the larger enterprises we're dealing with. But you know, the majority of folks that are coming through the door are either, you know, one or the other. They're actually trying to implement practical controls, and they're like, oh God, we can't really do this ourselves with the duct tape and twine we're used to. Or it's kind of on the other side of it. Like, hey, we need to prove to our customers that we, hey, look, we're on top of this. Going completely remote isn't something we plan for, but it's something we can address. So definitely interesting use cases, that's for sure.
Yeah, there seems to be this really crazy split where a lot of companies are splitting off and they're doing, you know, they're accelerating their sensible projects around, you know, like as you say, you've got people ringing you up saying, yeah, we need better visibility, auditability of our, you know, Linux fleet to assuage compliance and customer concerns, right? So they're doing it the right way. They're buying really good tools. And then you got the other ones where it's like, your username is your first name, your password is your last name, and here, just RDP into this unpatched Win 7 box, right? Like that, it feels like there's not much middle ground. It's either people doing it the really, really bad way or people doing it the really, really good way. Are you seeing that as well?
Yeah, we're definitely seeing a lot of Band-Aid fixes kind of rolled out. The amount of times we have folks come through and say, you know, hey, we're now trying to deal with the fact that, you know, we've had devs opening up, you know, their home IP addresses to SSH into prod, or they're opening up, you know, new gateways, or they've moved Jenkins to their laptop. So they're now having to have those development deployment kind of tools on their machine locally. They need to get those into prod. We're just seeing different maturity scales across the board. And it's not just like in passwords or just user accounts and credentials. It's kind of even getting into the practices people are doing. A lot of folks are really going manual on a lot of this stuff. And with others out of the office or kind of remote work starting to kind of creep in, you know, you've got those, oh, I'll just jump into prod, I'll make that change in the last minute and kind of wait for the deploy to kind of clear it out or update it in Git later. It's just that hangover that's going to hit pretty soon that we're all going to kind of feel. I guess things start to fall apart a little bit after the fact, but it's definitely been strange to see how people react to the change in the conditions and obviously just look, there are people doing a lot of really basic things really horribly, so hopefully we don't see a big fallout towards the end of the year in massive breaches and compromises that are only detected then, but I guess only time will tell.
Now look back on the freemium stuff that you were doing. This is interesting, right? Because in the identity and access management space, shelfware is a bit of a problem, isn't it? So the freemium approach is going to let customers actually take stuff out for a spin, put it in use, and then unlock greater functionality by spending cash. I mean, you and I are both aware of some crazy amounts of money wasted on licenses that never get deployed. This seems to be a particular issue in identity and access management, doesn't it?
Yeah, it's definitely something we've seen a lot of. And I guess as people have gone remote, it's really started to kind of put a lot of pressure on the tools that we've been using to get privileged access, whether it be on a Windows system or a Linux box in cloud. It's really started to kind of, you know, I guess make teams aware that, hey, that, you know, PAM tool that we've been using for the last few years actually isn't rolled out in prod across as diverse a fleet, a set of hosts as we thought it was. But, you know, I think on the other side of it, Pat, you know, people are trying to get to a point where they can understand if they've got a problem in the first place. And for a lot of our customers, we find they're really trying to run for that, you know, the solution that's going to do everything day one. They get 10 developers lined up, they get their full fleet ready to roll out a, you know, a PAM product or an IAM, you know, kind of technology in their cloud environment. And they kind of have to have all the stars align. Freemium for us is really about saying, look, you can find out if this is a challenge for your org without having to invest, you know, 5 developers' time. It's a couple of lines on a box to get the agent installed. It's super simple to get it set up and running. And then the report that you get at the end of it's going to tell you if you've got a bit of a challenge around shared access or kind of lateral movement, even account pivoting, just stuff that people need to kind of get in front of before they actually invest all of that longer term developer time with legacy tools. And I think that's always been a bit of a challenge or a barrier of entry to kind of the identity space. Everyone's trying to solve the end goal. We're all trying to get to that panacea when we don't know if we've got a problem in the first place and maybe how much of a challenge that is for our org at all in any way.
Now, we were expecting for your stuff to be GA at this point, but it's not. It's still like a special for Risky Biz listeners. You've sped up the pipeline a bit, though. So listeners who are interested in getting early access, because it is still early access and it is still pretty much exclusive to our listener base, they can go still sign up, can't they?
Absolutely. And one of the things that I will say, Pat, is, you know, if you are in that list, you'll be getting access pretty soon. In the next few weeks, we're starting to kind of open up that list a little bit broader. We've got a lot of really great initial feedback. And so, you know, as far as kind of getting product out there to folks, we're pretty pleased. As we kind of talked about, we've already got some that are paying customers, which is super exciting. But look, honestly, want folks to feel like they can try this stuff out. And you know, obviously with no risk or concerns about how that software is used in the long term. But you know, in the meantime, it's still an exclusive. We've kind of talked about it in very limited venues and a couple of other places, and hopefully we'll make this a little bit more broad when we can kind of deal with the risky business rush.
It's great. We're gonna throw customers at you. Awesome. You did mention too that there'd been some feedback and not all of it was great. Like, what did you get your ass kicked over? Because I mean, that was kind of the point of this exercise, right? Want negative feedback when you're doing something wrong. What product changes resulted from the last podcast we did?
Honestly, it's been really interesting. People wanted really broad reports that we hadn't really kind of offered in the past. They wanted better content, better templates around how we actually demonstrate a lot of this kind of usage pattern to kind of broader audiences. So we found that the majority of folks that were signing up were kind of engineering managers, engineering leads, sometimes just, you know, kind of security ops folks that have, you know, struggled with kind of getting these products into environments in the past. And a lot of our content's really targeted at those folks consuming and actually looking at the data.
That makes sense for you as well, right? Because if you start generating better reports for those people, they can then take them to their boss and say, hey, look, we obviously need budget here for this tool that just generated this report, right? So
yeah,
everybody
yeah.
wins.
Effectively, it's just about building really, you know, consistent executive reporting stuff that kind of came through. But on the other side of it, folks wanted to see some smoother deployment mechanisms. They actually wanted to see some different sensor tech that we've been trialing out a little bit over the last couple of months. So there's some surprises in there for folks to kind of take a look at too. We're adding a lot of extra observability with this agent release. So we're really, really proud of it. And it's been a huge amount of work on my engineering team. So thanks folks for working the last couple of weekends to get things polished. But you know, at the same time, you know, just quality improvements all around, better integrations, feedback on the kind of things that people want to see in Slack or you know, they want to see in PagerDuty, all the way down to just improvements around how we onboard folks, like how we could better, you know, message a particular installer or, you know, provide some more, you know, streamlined opening activities for when they get into the platform. So pretty exciting stuff. And you know, honestly, stuff that you don't really get to get a lot of feedback on in those kind of enterprise POCs where you're holding folks' hands. So, you know, it's pretty exciting for us to see it.
Being a vendor used to be about developing a product, pushing it out there, and then updating it every couple of years, maybe. And now yeah. it's like you really are still building the plane while you're flying it, right? And customers are okay with that. Like, that's the new, you know, agile, modern, DevOps-y style vendoring. You know, it's just what a time to be alive. What a time, Jake.
Absolutely. I think what's most interesting for me is just every time you get into an environment, you see a piece of software that's just sat there and they haven't done a major release in a couple of months, or they haven't added functionality for containers, or they're not able to work with Kubernetes or a different fleet. You just kind of think, well, you know, are they solving the right problem today? Maybe. Are they solving it tomorrow? Probably not. I think the advantage we have is, you know, being a bit more nimble, being able to ship like good quality software into environments and get great feedback about it. You know, just lets us build a better company altogether and solve problems for the folks that are, you know, struggling with this stuff day to day. Not making it, you know, bigger than Ben-Hur, making it a simple problem to actually solve and kind of using the right software to do it.
All right. Well, Jake King, we wish you the best of luck with this next push out to the listeners who are your early customers and beta testers. Oh, some of your early customers, you got plenty of them. But yeah, it's been a real pleasure to chat to you. Stay safe over there in Canada, my friend, and we'll talk to you again soon.
Thanks again, Pat.
That was Jake King of CMD Security there. Big thanks to him for that. And that is it for this week's show. I do hope you've enjoyed it. I'll be back tomorrow with a soapbox edition of the podcast. But until then, I've been Patrick Gray. Thanks for listening.